No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and we hope together that our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the discussion. In fact, we'd like you to be part of this discussion. You can call in at 888-627-6008. Maria Sanchez, how are you?
Doing okay. I just found out that one of my dearest friends from college is in the hospital, unconscious, on life support, and it happens to be COVID positive, but I don't think contributed. So it just is a further example about how precious life is.
Yeah.
Young 60s, healthy guy, and fell, broke ribs, which punctured the lung, which filled up, which caused a heart attack, which unconscious, flatlined for 30 minutes. So it doesn't look good.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry to share that with you. I just learned about it in the past hour.
You know what? We certainly, we've certainly seen a lot of that here in Washington. My next door neighbor died of COVID. One of my dearest friend's moms died of COVID, and so we're all having to deal with these things these days. And then on top of that, people that just, don't have COVID and die, right? That's just
right.
A natural
I mean, it
part
just
of life,
out
or that is exacerbated by it. Yeah.
So I there were three of us were best friends, two guys and me, and I reached out to our other best friend because he didn't know, and he is the medical director of the District of Columbia's fire department or first responders or something.
Oh,
anyway,
is that right?
We just spoke. Yes, and he told me that they're getting inoculated or getting the vaccine 2 weeks from Tuesday.
Yeah, there was a fight over it actually. Maybe we should start the show there that D.C. said it wasn't getting enough of it. I can't remember what they said, 50,000 doses or something, and they were fighting to get more of it. But that's great. It's great to know that.
Because he said that there's 1,900 folks in his department, so they're and he said, and these are not risk-adverse people. They run into a fire. So they don't think that, being in an ambulance with somebody who's coughing and sneezing that has COVID is necessarily going to affect them. So I guess they're considered essential frontline, and they're getting it. And I asked which one, and he said the Pfizer one.
Well, and you know what? I can't remember how many people in the EMS service in D.C. and the D.C. Fire Department were actually came down with COVID, but they said this the other day. They gave the number the other day, and I was just astounded at how many
I think
many
he
people.
Told me 79.
In his department?
Anyway,
well, let me say, I have an announcement to make before we get too far in the show. For those of you, we put it out on social media that A. Scott Bolden was going to be our guest tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Unfortunately, there was a conflict that his staff wasn't aware of. So at the last minute, he had to cancel yesterday. But he'll be back. He promised us he'll come back in the next few weeks. So
Great. If
you're tuning in to hear Scott, stay and listen to me and Maria. And then either next week or the following week, soon he will be back on the show. So
that's a good segue to what we did also, because we spoke later this week, the senator and I did, and we wanted to make sure that we talked a little bit about the folks that President-elect Joe Biden is selecting to be on his team. And one of them, the senator just happened to mention, oh, yeah, when I was 25 and she was 27, we worked together. And I was like, you know, not very many people can make statements like you do, Michael. And why don't you fill us in about who she is and why you happen to be working together? And then maybe we can go into a little more details about what it is that you have lived in your life as a political operative and a consultant and a senator.
Well, you know, we go back to our early jobs together. The woman's name is Tina Flannoy. She's a lawyer. She's had many, many political jobs. But we go back to the beginning of our careers together. And you know how those jobs are, right? You're overworked. You're overpaid.
Underpaid,
I'm sorry. Nobody in the history of the Democratic National Committee has ever been overpaid. So you're overworked and underpaid, and you bond. And Tina was a lawyer at the DNC. I can't remember exactly what area she worked in, whether it was compliance or fundraising, but I was head of the in-house direct mail programs. And so we worked together. I worked with a guy that I was, joined at the hip with, named Brian, and Tina. Tina and Brian were very, very close. And Tina and I got to know each other over that time. And now, you know, I followed her career, and she's at Georgetown University right now, and she's just been appointed to be Kamala Harris's chief of staff. So that's pretty big deal, not only because it's an important position, but this is a woman that'll be making history. You know, because everything these guys do will be historic. She's the first African American and the first woman to have a position this high in the administration. There's never been a woman vice president, and she's a black woman. So lots of what she does will set precedents. And you know, we're all proud of Tina, and I'm sure she'll do a great job. But, you know, the DNC, when I worked at DNC, I worked on Jimmy Carter's reelection. Not that that went very well, but it was an incubator. Mark Warner, senator from Virginia, worked in the office across the hall. Terry McAuliffe, former governor of Virginia and top DNC fundraiser, a Democratic fundraiser, I wouldn't be surprised to see him get a position in the new administration. He also worked at DNC. Ron Brown, who became the Secretary of Commerce. Ann Lewis, who became the National Political Director. Maggie Williams, who was the Chief of Staff for Hillary Clinton. All these people worked with me at the DNC, and I knew them all. Some I was closer to than others. Nancy Pelosi's aide-de-camp was a dear friend of mine. Maggie Williams was a dear friend of mine. And so, you know, I worked with a lot of these people, and the DNC was a great incubator in those days. Turned out a lot of top political people. So got a lot of experience doing that, and also very proud of that. You know, Jimmy Carter, I don't care what people have to say about whether he was a good president or a bad president, he was a great human being. He's, I want to say, 96, and he's still working on building houses for the poor, mm-hmm. and he's still teaching Sunday school, right? Mm-hmm. Maria, right. You and I had a woman on our show, a national media person, Eleanor Clift. We had her on our show the week after she came back from coming to his Sunday school class. And there's still people that wait in their cars overnight to go attend Sunday service when he's preaching. So, excuse me, he's a great guy, and we're very proud to have worked for him. And, I mean, I could go on. I could take the whole show over people that we've worked with, people that I worked with at the DNC who went on to greatness. And, you know, and I also worked on five presidential campaigns now. On two or three of them, I was paid. Let me think about it. At least three of them, I was paid, a paid consultant, and a couple of them, I just volunteered. I volunteered for John Kerry, and I volunteered for Obama. But I've been a super delegate five times now, I think. No, four times. Four times I've been a super delegate, and five times. You know, when you get old, you forget these things. But
well, I'm sure.
You know, Obama twice, Biden, Clinton, four times. I'm sorry, but anyway, I've done it a lot of times. I've been at every Democratic nominating convention for the last 11 years. Dominating conventions. That's 44 years of conventions, and I haven't missed one. So, you know, I started in this when I was a kid, and you know, now I'm an old man. And you know, it's funny that there was a guy. You know, it's really interesting the little things that happen in your life that really change the direction. Now, I was in a dilemma when I started my consulting firm. It wasn't exactly what I wanted to do. I wanted to have a life in politics, and I didn't really want to be a consultant. I wanted to be more intimately involved. And I had lunch one day with a friend of mine who said to me, "Be intimately involved?" I go, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you don't need to make any money at politics," which may have been bad advice the way things have ended up, but he said, "You can just do it. You can do it. You can make your money doing something else," you know? And so that's what happened. I did the consulting, and I consulted to politicians, but I did kind of nuts and bolts type of consulting, campaigning primarily, not really governance, but campaigning, getting people elected. And then I got involved in all sorts of other ways. You know, I've just been asked to be a speaker at an international conference with the former top political person in the Carter administration, Stu Eisenstadt. So, you know, I've gotten to do so many interesting things because of the positions I've had, and I didn't have to make money at it. I made money at other things. But that's the wonderful thing about politics. If there's any young people out there listening, go into politics. You can make money and help people. It's a win-win.
Well, and what I didn't realize until I got involved with my local governance, i.e. city council and board of supervisors, right, for example, that there is you have a lot, whoever gets elected, has a lot of control and power over what affects us on a day-in and day-out basis. Because we often only think about state and national politics, but what happens right in your own backyard can be influenced by your next-door neighbor or whomever is on those positions. Not to mention, it's pretty lucrative. And, you know, I mean, it's not big, but it's certainly more than six figures and the benefits and everything that you get if you can retire from it. I also didn't realize that either.
In D.C., I mean, look, these guys that serve on the city council, they have large staffs. They get $130,000 a year, and it's a part-time job. They're allowed to have outside employment. So some of them and I don't believe in that. I don't believe you should have an outside employment, but several of them do. And some of them have made as much as $300,000 or $400,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Between their outside employment and their government job. And so, it really can be lucrative, but don't do it for the money.
Well, I didn't know
that. It's a hard
that.
Way to go, you know, unfortunately.
Well, and there's no guarantee, too, if you're elected.
Right,
you don't
there's
know
no
about
guarantee.
The next cycle. Right.
And being elected, you got to put yourself out there. Look, there's only a certain amount of people that will do it because of that. I mean, mm-hmm. Let me tell you something. You can be the finest person on the planet And when you put yourself out there and stand up before the public, people will attack you. Mm-hmm. People will also support you, and that feels very good. Let me tell you, I got one election, I got 207,000 votes. And, you know, when 207,000 people vote for you, it feels good.
But
I've also been accused publicly in the newspapers. I had one of my teenage children call me hysterical one time because she was at a slumber party, and it was reported in the front section of the Washington Post that people were calling me a racist. And she's like, "Dad, how can they do that? I'm sitting here in a room full of black people, my friends, you know, people who come to our house and my roommate's black, and my, you know, how can they say this about you?" And, you know, it's the First Amendment. You can say whatever you want. You have to have a thick skin. And let me tell you, that's another thing. If you're going to run for political office, you've got to consider those around you, because it's harder on them than it is on me. And I know you're a sports fan, so I will give you the analogy I always use with my wife. My wife is a big basketball fan. And I say, "You know what, honey? It's not nice to throw an elbow in the NBA. It's against the rules. But if you can't take an elbow, you need to be doing something else for a living, because that's how the game's played." And that's it in politics, too. People feel that they can say anything and do anything to win. Of course, we're seeing that today. Yeah. We're going to talk about a few of those things in a minute. But you know what I want to make very clear? What we need to do going forward from this point is figure out a way to heal America and bring people back together. So I don't want to say anything,
disparaging.
Bad about either candidate, disparaging, thank you, about either candidate in the previous presidential election, which I guess is still going on. But I do want to say it's time for us to get together and move the country forward, because none of this is helping us. And, you know, we have a candidate that got over 81 million votes and a candidate that got 74 million votes. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of votes. And that's a lot, and that's a big split in America. And we really need to do something about that.
Well, it would help if there was modeling, and I think once the inauguration happens, I believe that there will be more of that, you know, taking the high road and trusting science and, leading by example with the mask wearing and all of that stuff, because as you well know, we're in for a world of hurt now with the surge upon the surge. And I worry for everyone's livelihood. They're talking about almost 450,000 deaths by April. That's a lot of people. They said this morning on Meet the Press that this is the biggest crisis that we will have faced as a nation, period.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, I don't know if I right from the start took it as serious business because I've got underlying conditions, or because I lost an aunt to the influenza epidemic of the early 1900s. I had an aunt, Edith, that I never met, obviously. She was my mother's younger sister, but I always heard about her, and she died in the influenza epidemic of the early 1900s. I think it was 1913, 1912. I've taken it seriously right from the beginning, but people still are not taking it seriously. And then there's also burnout. You know, there was a guy in New York today that ran over a sheriff's deputy who was trying to effectuate an arrest and charge this guy because he was running a bar in violation of, you know, what the regulations are right now. He probably would have been charged with some sort of misdemeanor. But now he's lost everything. He's going to lose the bar. He's probably going to lose his freedom. And I get it. I ran a business for 25 years. I get that this is horrible for people, you know, that they're losing their businesses. But we can't do anything until we get this under control. And that's a real problem.
The problem is like threefold, because one, there's the COVID fatigue, because this has been going on since March, right? And then two, there is the actual loss. They say now that at least 50% of Americans know somebody that has COVID or died from COVID. Because it used to be we would say to each other, do you know anybody from, you know? And it's like, no, well, now that's not the case. And then number three is that the behavior, if it isn't followed, is only going to exacerbate it. And that also leads to the mental health decline, because one, it does affect us because of all the reasons that you just mentioned. And two, people who are diagnosed with COVID within 3 months, 30% of them have some sort of mental diagnosis, either depression or PTSD or anxiety. So it's not just physical.
Well, and you know what? Beyond the mental as well, and by the way, we tried to get somebody on the show to talk about this week, but I guess these people are so busy right now.
Yes.
We hesitated for a moment because this has become such a big issue. But also in the paper today, opioid deaths in Washington, D.C. from fentanyl are off the charts. And they're saying there's several reasons for this. One is what you just said, that, you know, the isolation and kind of a PTSD thing. There's also, they're saying, due to the isolation, people that would normally be using drugs around other people who would be able to provide assistance, right? Take them to the hospital or notify somebody. But now they're alone. And they think some people are just dying of overdoses because they've overdosed and there's nobody around to help them. So, I mean, this is on every level. You know, I have a daughter who was laid off from her job. You know, everybody's being affected by this. Mm-hmm. And we really, really need to get it under control. And
before
we
can get the vaccine, because most of us won't because of the pecking order, which I also understand, that means that we have to continue to stay at home.
Right, and it's not a and the vaccine's not a panacea.
Correct.
You know, people think it is, but it's not. You know, you need a couple of doses of it. And today, the head of the CDC said on Meet the Press this morning, I think it was,
that
the worst is yet to come.
Yes.
That January and February are going to be horrible. So, you know,
In California, we have a mandatory lockdown that's starting tonight at midnight. So,
yeah, and you know why? Because they reported 30,000 cases a day now in California.
Well, and they said anytime you go below 15% of ICU beds availability, it kicked that in, and that happened. So
of course.
In my little tiny county, it went down to 13.5 or something, and that's... So, and we're considered Southern California from Santa Barbara south all the way to San Diego. Everybody, it's starting tonight at midnight. So,
well,
it's,
and I've
got
to tell you,
it was.
One of the most horrible things for me, I'm really, really tired of seeing these young women on TV, these nurses who are exhausted, who... some of them seem to be in their 20s and 30s who have to hold the hands of people as they die because their families can't get to them. The emotional stress that this is putting on these women and the physical stress and men or male nurses and first responders and all these other, it's just horrible. And imagine if they get to a point where they're going to have to decide, they're going to have to come and say, we're not going to treat your friend that went in the hospital today because we don't think he's got as good a chance of recovery as the guy next to him. I mean, who wants to make those choices?
And the ethics involved in that, too, is terrible because whose life is more valuable, really, is what it's coming down to, right?
Of course.
And that's what they're struggling with. I had an incident when my second son was less than 2 years old. He developed... within hours, a breathing disorder where he couldn't, like when he took a breath, you could see his ribs. And he had just been to the pediatrician that morning for his well check. And I call, and the pediatrician says, call 911, get in the ambulance, I'll meet you at the hospital. And we were living in the Bay Area, Northern California at the time. So I do just that. And I'm pregnant with my third child and get a sitter for the other baby that's at home. Yeah. And we're going to the hospital, and the nurses were on strike. So we couldn't get there. So we had to go 70 more miles to San Francisco to get to a hospital that would treat him with the oxygen and all of that sort of thing. And that's what's going to be happening with other people. Yes. If there's no room at the inn, you're going to be driving around. Where am I going to go? Because nobody can take us. And they could die in transit, let alone they don't, you know, who knows how many hundreds of miles they might have to go to find a bed.
Yeah. And especially in rural areas where, it's likely that not only your hospital will fill up, but the hospital in the next town and the hospital in the next town, and the hospital in the next town. I mean, it's going to be hard. We need to really get this under control. So this leads
And that me. Means canceling Hanukkah and Christmas and Kwanzaa.
Yeah.
Just like people should have canceled Thanksgiving. Because that's why they say we haven't seen the surge from the Thanksgiving yet, in the middle of the surge that we're already in.
Yeah.
And most people that I know, including my family, we've agreed that we're not going to have a holiday together.
Yeah, it's a very hard time to do that. And, especially when you get to be my age, for example. I've got a daughter that lives in Chicago. I've got a daughter that lives in Baltimore. This is a chance for us all to get together, and we don't get those chances very often anymore. You know, a couple times a year I see my oldest daughter if I'm lucky. And so we had to come up with a plan. They're going to come home for Thanksgiving, but they're
going to
both. I mean, I'm sorry, for Christmas. But the older one is going to stay with the younger one in Baltimore. They're both going to be tested when she arrives. My younger daughter's been tested 4 or 5 times already because she works in a restaurant. She's now stopped working in the restaurant. And she and my daughter are going to go be tested. And then they're going to isolate themselves for 10 days before they come home.
That's perfect.
Yeah,
and
it's just going to be us. I have spent every Christmas Eve for the past 50 years, 51 years in a row, I spent Christmas Eve with my former next-door neighbors, and this will probably be the first year that we don't do that. Because
it's sad, and
it's
all
sad.
I keep thinking is, this too shall pass. And
when
it does, and when we can get back to, quote, whatever normal was, I don't know. I mean, I was in Tokyo in, 2005 or 6, and everybody wears a mask there.
Yeah.
And it was the weirdest thing, because I was thinking, is there an air quality problem? But because of their density and their subways and all of that sort of stuff, just walking down the street, they all had masks.
Yeah.
And that may be what we do for the rest of our lives.
Yes. Unfortunately, that may be.
Yeah. And you know, personally, I don't mind. I think it's a small price to pay, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the least we can do because it's not about you. It's about me. And it's about the people around you. It's not, people have grasped onto this idea that there's something political in mass, that it's your right to decide as an American whether or not to wear a mask or not, and that shouldn't be the case. It shouldn't be your right to decide, because it's not about your personal freedom. It's about protecting the people around you.
Mm-hmm.
And we do many things legally to protect the people around us. We wear, we have mandatory seatbelt laws.
Mm-hmm.
You're not allowed. You can't come into a public place, and like a restaurant or a grocery store, and light up a cigarette. That's not your prerogative because of secondhand smoke. You can smoke all you want in your house. Mm-hmm. You know, stay there and do it. And but you know,
San Francisco just banned smoking in people's homes, but they gave an exemption to marijuana. And they said,
well,
it's because
God bless
you can't
San Francisco,
smoke,
you know. You gotta love
well, you can't
guys.
Smoke marijuana outside legally. So
well,
they said
you can't
that was
either.
Why they gave it the exemption.
You can't here in D.C. either, although we have a very liberal marijuana law. And the funny thing, I don't want to get off too much on a tangent, but, you know, this is related to the fact that we don't have the same basic civil rights that everybody else has. You can give marijuana to anybody in Washington. You can give somebody 2 ounces of marijuana. You can grow up to, I think it is like 3 or 4 plants per person in your household who's old enough, you know, who's an adult. But you can't buy it. It's illegal to buy it anywhere. You can, if you have a card, I guess, you get medical marijuana. But you can't buy it from anybody. You can only
you don't
give
have,
it.
Michael, you don't have dispensaries?
We do have a couple. But, you know, you have to have a note from a doctor and blah, 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 blah. But you can give it to me. And it's funny, when they first passed the law, I go to this public forum, and this guy stands up and he says to the chief of police, he says, suppose I go over to my friend Charlie's, and Charlie says to me, hey, Joe, here's an ounce of marijuana. And I say, gee, thanks, Charlie. And when I'm walking out the door, I go, oh, you know what, Charlie? Here's the $300 I borrowed from you that I forgot to give back to you. And the chief looked at him and said, yeah, we understand. It's going to be very hard to enforce this. And there's no way you can enforce it. But it's just that when we pass the law, this is how it works in D.C. You pass a law, and then it has to go to Congress. And if Congress doesn't take action against the law, it becomes law. But if they do, they can overturn it. So that's what they did. They allowed it to become law. And actually, I think it was they forgot to do something, so it became law. They slipped up in the waiting period. It became
law.
I can't
imagine what that's like for you to have mom and daddy make those decisions.
Yeah, then they turned around and said, if you even make a law, if you even have a meeting of the city council to discuss how to regulate it, we will throw you in jail. You're not allowed to regulate it in any way. You're not allowed. So that's where we stand.
Wow.
You can't make any, we can't tax it, for example. You know, we can't, there's nothing we can do with it. So that's
for the listeners who don't understand why that is, that's because the District of Columbia is not a state and can't make some important decisions for themselves.
Right. You know, actually, the thing is that the Constitution says that the Congress shall have exclusive legislation, make all the laws in the District of Columbia if they choose to. It doesn't say that we can't be a state. It doesn't say we can't have representation. It doesn't say that we can't be like everybody else. It just says it's up to Congress to decide whatever they want to do with us. And that's what they've done with us over the years. They've decided that we shouldn't have representation, that we shouldn't be able to make our own laws. About 40 years, a little 40 years plus ago, maybe 44, 45 years ago, they gave us a mayor and a city council. But still, they're subjected to the rule of Congress. So it's really not even that any of these rights we can't have any of these rights under the Constitution. We actually can, except Congress can decide one way or the other, and they always have. So they've made these decisions that really haven't worked in our favor. So we're kind of under So we call Washington very often call it the last colony because really do treat us like a colony.
Yes. But back to your earlier conversation about Tina Flournoy, who Kamala Harris selected to be her chief of staff. Mm-hmm. She also selected a couple of other women and of color that are breaking that ceiling. There's a meme out there that says, hey, women, make sure you've got your shoes on because there's lots of glass going around because of the glass ceiling being broken. Yeah. But and Biden too with his picks. I think one of the greatest picks is this Janet Yellen. She, you know, between Biden and Janet Yellen, it makes turning 70 and 70 something not look so bad. Well, look at, she's 74, I think, and she'll be the first chair as Secretary of the Treasury woman, and she was the first woman of the Federal Reserve. I mean, talk about groundbreaking, and of course this has to be confirmed, but still, it's these kinds of choices, I think, are bold and empowering and also give black and brown and female people something to hope for.
Well, you know, I was there on the floor of the convention, surrounded by women who were sobbing. I was at the front of the stage, literally surrounded by hundreds of women who were sobbing when Geraldine Ferraro became the first woman vice presidential candidate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've come a long way since then. And we talked. When Ferraro got the nomination, people started to talk about women and money. You know, they would say there is no difference between men's issues and women's issues in most cases. You know, women are concerned about jobs. Women are concerned about money. Women are concerned about a better, you know, having a better life and good health care and things for their children. Up to that point, they really did, believe it or not, think that, you know, some issues were men's issues and some issues were women's issues. So it really doesn't seem like that long to me that it's taken to come to a point, you know. And let's point out that we are one of the few countries, major countries in the world, that hasn't had a woman president.
Right.
Israel, but to your point, India, about money, France, England. I mean, we could go on and on.
Yep. Yeah. And your point about money, that he's appointed Neera Tanden to be the director of the Office of Management and Budget, who would be the first woman to do that. And she's a South Asian American. She's only 50. And she's been in both the Clinton and Obama administrations. And then you mentioned earlier John Kerry, special envoy for the climate. Yep. But one of my role models is this Linda Thomas-Greenfield as the United Nations ambassador. She's been around 35 years in the United States Foreign Service. And President-elect Biden plans to elevate this position of United Nations ambassador to the cabinet level. And she's a woman of color. So, I mean, it goes on and on about what he's done so far.
Yeah, and the California Attorney General has just been, people say he's going to be Javier Becerra is his name, I think.
Yes.
And he's going to, you know, be picked to lead HHS, which is the rumor. So, yeah, you're going to have
The Secretary of Homeland Security is a refugee from Havana, Cuba.
Yeah.
I mean, and as he said, it's going to be as diverse as America is, and he's backing it up. So I just think it's hopeful and promising. And on your point that you mentioned earlier about helping us to heal, I would think that would be a major step in that direction when people can say, that person looks like me, or that person looks like me, or there's hope for me, or, you know, and I don't think this is a party thing. I think this is a people thing. And I'm hopeful that what you said about healing will indeed happen next month.
Well, me too. And, you know, I often use the example of my older sister. I had a sister who unfortunately passed away in her mid-40s. She was 10 years older than me. When she graduated from law school, there were like two or three women in her graduating class. And when she got older, when she was in her early 40s, she went to be part of a commencement at her law school. Now, she went to GW Law School. She didn't go to a little tiny law school somewhere. She went to a big law school. But the year that she went was the first year that they had more women graduates than they had men. And that was like 20-some years after she graduated. So, you know, the more women you have, the more women you're going to get. The more black and brown people you have, the more black and brown people you're going to get. You know, it really is about breaking that glass ceiling.
Well, and the law of attraction, too.
Yes.
You know, that's why diversity, equity, and inclusion is so important now, which is something I really want to get involved in post-PhD, because I've worked in super diverse environments, and I felt that the building thrived, and there was a buzz and an energy that I didn't get in the all-white corridors that I have also been in. And I was talking about one of the major radio stations that I worked for in Los Angeles. They're like the number one in the country. There was the black general manager, and then an Asian sales manager, female, and then a gay manager, and then a, you know, we were filled with diversity and Asian Pacific, and I just loved it. It was like, oh my gosh, we're going to make, I think you make better decisions when you have different perspectives coming into play.
Oh,
because you bring your experience to the room and the decision.
Absolutely, and we need to get more of that. And, you know, on the basis of everything that you just said and I've said, I do want to say just a few things because I think that we have a responsibility to point this out. I want to say something to all the Trump supporters out there that might be listening. First, I want to say that I've run five times for citywide positions. I've won three times and I've lost twice. It's hard to lose. It's very, very, very hard to lose. You put your whole self into a campaign. The people around you give you money and support, and very often they're enthusiastic about who you are. So I get it that it's not easy to lose an election. But it's time for us to move on and bring America back together. And what people have to understand out there, I've been on the internet for a couple of weeks now, seeing there's a lot of vitriol on the internet. And look, I've been a Democrat my whole life, but I'm not a hypocrite. I admit that we have the same thing on the Democratic side very often. There were people that never accepted Trump's election because Hillary Clinton got three million more votes, even though we all know that our electoral process hinges on the Electoral College. And if you don't like that, then change the Electoral College. Don't try to change the rules after the election. So it's not just, you know, I don't want to make it sound like it's just Republicans out there or just Trump supporters out there that are doing this. It happens on both sides. But now is time to move on. You know, we have a coronavirus epidemic in America. And yesterday, the president held a rally in Georgia where there were thousands of people. Almost nobody had a mask. There was no social distancing. This has to stop. We have to move on and accept responsibility and also heal. And people should know out there, if you're a supporter of Donald Trump, President Trump, there's nothing you can do at this point to change the process. So if you want to let, if you think that the president has a right to follow all his legal options and file whatever lawsuits he wants to do and talk to whatever governors he wants to do, great. Just let him do it. The process will work itself through, and in the end, we'll have a result. You don't need to, we don't all need to be out there bashing each other like one side is going to beat the other by getting on the internet and saying horrible things about one another. It's time to bring us together. And nothing that's going on right now, none of the lawsuits, nothing, none of it's going to amount to anything in the end, because in 9 days the electors will go will elect a new president. We've had the votes recounted three times now in Georgia. We've had the Trump people pay for a recount in Wisconsin, which produced a mistake. Yeah, Joe Biden got 100 and some more votes. And you know what? If you did, I've been involved in electoral politics for 40 years. If you did a recount in every state, you would find that in every state. You would find that in some states, President Trump got a handful more votes. And in other states, Joe Biden got a hand, Vice President Biden got a handful of more votes. Because anything that involves people and 145 million votes, there's going to be some mistakes. Mm-hmm. But nothing's going to overturn the results of this election. And now it's time to move on. And I assume that you heard that Rudy Giuliani is now in the hospital with COVID.
No.
Yeah. He's
I
now
know his son had it.
He's now in Georgetown University Hospital. He's got COVID. He just was at hearings with, and court proceedings and hearings with people in Pennsylvania and Nevada. And so many of those people could end up in the hospital, too, with COVID. And after the 30, you know, after the thing in Georgia yesterday, you know, that'll probably be a super spreader event, too. And we have to stop this. And one other thing, the last thing I want to say to the Trump people is that you're not doing yourself any favors here. This guy, you know, what happened in Georgia yesterday is probably going to have a bad effect on the election of the two United States senators that are up for election, the two seats that are up for election in Georgia. Right now, as we speak, there's a televised debate going on between Laffer and Warnock. But what the president is doing and what his supporters are doing is not helping that. If you really believe in Donald Trump and you believe he should be president of the United States, my advice is to start working on his 2024 campaign. That's how we do it in America, if you believe in somebody. There's nothing that's going to overturn the results of these elections. And you know what? You can take the next 9 days to ruminate about it, but when the decision is made, then we need to come back and try to come together. You know, you and I have talked about this many times, Maria, that there used to be a thing about being an American, you know? That right. seems to have faded over time. I lived through the 1960s. Of course, you're way too young to remember the 1960s, but I remember them. I remember 1968 pretty vividly. It was shortly before I registered for the draft in the middle of a war. So it was very important to me, and the country was very, very unsettled. But you know what? I've heard all these things about how Democrats are terrible and Republicans are terrible and blah, 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 blah. But I've never heard anybody stand up and say, I'm so sorry I'm an American. I'm so sorry that I live in America. I'm so sorry that I was born here. No. Right? I mean, when do people ever say that?
It's well, there a great is country. An art, because as we were taught when we were growing up, don't be a sore loser. There's something known as a good loser. And it's funny that the word is almost pejorative, loser, because somebody has to lose, right? Not everybody gets to be a winner. So psychologically, they say there's 8 steps to being a good loser. And the first thing, the first step is to take the time to mourn the loss. Right. It's natural to get upset after you lose something, whatever it is. Then somehow be positive, because they say winning without honor is worse than a loss. And then be true to yourself and your values. And then own the loss. Take it on. And then determine why you lost. Raise your game. They say something about turning barriers into hurdles so that it's you know, it's a bump in the road. It's not a dead end. And then don't quit. You know, and that's just advice to people who are sympathetic to President Trump and don't want to accept the results, but psychologically, it's important that you do accept the results.
Right, I get that. And you know, they say the same thing about when somebody close to you passes, right? One of mm-hmm. the first things that phases that you go through is denial. So I get it. And like I say, I lost a race one time, citywide, against a guy that spent $10 for every dollar I spent, was the incumbent, and Gallup did a poll 6 weeks out from the election, and I was up 12 points among likely voters. And then I lost the election by more than 10 points. And there were people that came to me, and they said, oh, that couldn't have happened. That would be impossible. How could you be up 12 points and then you lose at the last minute? How can that be? Blah, blah. It's a contest, and when it's over, it's over. And I understood that. And I said, you know, they were saying, oh, you should file a complaint. Oh, we should have an investigation. And I'm like, no, we shouldn't. The people have spoken. I trust that the people that counted the votes were honest. I trust. And you know, that's the thing. I understand the angst. I understand why people are upset about losing. But what I don't understand is how they've gone about that. They don't understand what happened. You know what I mean? Why is it only states in which the president lost that we need to have a recount? We don't need to have a recount. Nobody's recounting votes in Utah or Texas or Florida, right?
Or California.
right? You know, it's like we're just grasping at straws because we can't understand. We can't accept.
Well,
and you're right,
the
goodness, you have to accept.
Though. To me, the encouraging news is that many people voted,
right.
Unprecedented, right? And so what I've often said prior to this election is, if you don't vote, your opinion doesn't matter to me. You know, so like if you participate in the process, the other thing about more people voting is that the winner represents the majority of people because the majority of people have voted, if that's the case. Whereas, like, especially in off-year elections or sometimes local elections, a minority of people elect the winners. And then that means that individual isn't representing the majority of people because the majority of people chose not to participate.
Right.
So I think the good news in this is that so many people did make this an important part of their life. Excuse me. And I hope that continues moving forward, especially 2 years from now.
Well, and you know what? It's not, they didn't, you know, the Republicans didn't lose. The Democrats lost 19 seats in the United States House
Correct.
Of Representatives. And if they don't louse up what's going on in Georgia, they may have retained, they've at least retained, regardless of what happens, a tie in the United States Senate. And they have a president who is about to retire, at least temporarily, who's got 74 million people. Believe me, I'm a politician. People will listen to 74 million people.
Yes.
I mean, they're acting like as soon as he's out of office, that's it. The Democrats take over everything, everybody's gone. That's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, they control two-thirds of all power in the United States. They control the Supreme Court, which is one-third. They control the executive branch, and they control half of the legislative branch at this point. So there's still a lot that Republicans control, and it's not
well, and
the end of the world.
Well, and that they can be proud of, too.
Yes, absolutely.
That they're not the marginalized party that some have said.
They're not the marginalized party. And
right.
And you know what? This I want this to be the final word because we're running out of time, but, you know, we started this show with the idea that we could have a Republican and a Democrat together that could have a civil conversation and could move things forward on internet radio. I don't have Maria is a Republican. We don't always agree, but you know what? I respect her. I trust her, and that's the basis of, you know, our relationship. And we need to get that going around the country. We all need to be in that place. And
well, not to mention that when the disagreements are intelligent and respectful,
right.
It's not bad to disagree.
Right.
How
it's
boring
not.
Would life be if we all agreed about everything?
Right, and that's helpful. You know, John F. Kennedy, that was his management style. He would try to get opposing people in a room, and I do it a lot of times too. He would try to get opposing people in the room so he could hear all sides of an argument before he made a decision. And my father used to say, you can never, ever, ever learn anything from somebody that agrees with you. You can only learn something new from somebody that disagrees with you. So there's a lot to be said for that. And in the midst of all this disagreement, before I let my charming co-host say goodbye, I'm going to tell you that today's song, I tormented over what we were going to play, given the nature of the show. But we're going to leave you with a song that's just been released by Carrie Underwood called Let There Be Peace on Earth. Because that's really what we need to do, America. We need to heal.
And we also want to thank you for listening, because we know you've got lots of choices. And it's always our honor and privilege to be here with you every week.
So thanks. We'll see you. Thanks, Maria.
You're welcome, Michael. Thank you.
Let there be peace, peace to every nation. Let there be hope for all the world to see. Let there be love and joy to all the children. Let there be peace on earth.
The in the capital of this nation. Of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.